This week on the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
Porphyria, what a great discussion topic. It's my favorite diagnosis.
Alex talked about vaping associated lung injury, which I agree, Alex, is arguably the hottest topic in medicine right now.
This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while edited by residents, is not verified by hosts or speakers, and we are not content experts on these topics. The content provided by the podcast is not intended and should not construe as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We attempt to avoid use of opinion, but all opinions represented are our own and are not representative of employer. Please keep this in mind as we enjoy our podcast.
Welcome to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
So we're back with another episode with the Chiefs, but before we get into it, we've got a big event coming up this month.
Yeah, Funuary. Usually February is a time of the year where residents struggle a little bit more. It's darker, it's still a little chilly. I won't say cold since we're in Tennessee, but we have organized events every single day.
And that makes up the month of Funuary, led by our Chiefs. So we're really looking forward to getting started with that. Casey, what was your favorite Funuary event last year?
I actually got to host a trivia night at Mellow Mushroom, which was very fun. We didn't win, but I think we got second place, if I'm remembering correctly. The pizza was good, though.
All right, there you go. I'm a big Hot Chicken and Santas guy. That's a year-long event that we have here that you just have to be here to understand it. And we'll leave it at that.
It does involve karaoke, though.
So let's go ahead and get into our episode here. We've got Peter with us, and we're going to learn a little bit more about vaping and
porphyria.
I do have to say my favorite Funuary event last year was Casey's trivia night at Mellow Mushroom, because I was on the winning team. And it was very satisfying. Although I do have to say I am excited. We're going to be doing our Super Bowl party as part of Funuary at our program director's house. And it is hypothetically possible, although slightly unbelievable, that the Titans yes. could make it all the way wow. down to Florida. See, I mean, they did just beat two good teams. But anyway, I don't want to jinx anything. So we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Our first topic that we're going to cover today is acute intermittent porphyria. And this was presented by Xuan Ding. And this happens to be Dr. Chrisman's favorite topic.
Well, porphyria, what a great discussion topic. It's my favorite diagnosis.
When I say favorite topic, I mean he ends every single differential that he makes with, and it could be porphyria. And obviously, most of the time, it's not right. But the reason we jest with it, it's one of those conditions that is frequently overlooked. So the patients who are presenting with acute intermittent porphyria present with a wide array of very vague symptoms that are very episodic in nature and frequently not recognized. Most commonly, 95% of them come in with abdominal pain, and this abdominal pain can be associated with nausea and vomiting and bloating, and a lot of very nonspecific findings that can be normal for some people or part of kind of the irritable bowel syndrome spectrum. And then they also come in with neurologic complaints, and these can represent everything from central, peripheral, autonomic, sensory, and motor presentations as well. Some of those complaints include things like anxiety, restlessness, agitation, depression, phobias, hallucinations, somnolence. And because of these kind of obvious, sometimes psychiatric in nature complaints, the diagnosis is overlooked and not found. The average number of physicians that folks with porphyria present to is 15. And it can take over 10 years to reach a diagnosis. And that's interesting because acute intermittent porphyria is a genetic condition. It's autosomal dominant, but has a very low penetrance. And because of that, people will frequently not have a strong family history and be unaware that it is a genetic defect that is running in their family.
Peter, what is acute intermittent porphyria and why are all of these symptoms happening?
Acute intermittent porphyria, or AIP, is one of four porphyria disorders. They are all from different enzymes in the heme biosynthesis pathway that have defects. So if you're missing one of the enzymes, your heme intermediates pile up kind of at a different place in the heme pathway. The most common one is acute intermittent porphyria. The other ones are ALA dehydratase porphyria, which is obviously from a deficiency of ALA dehydratase. And then acute intermittent porphyria, the topic today, which is from porphobilinogen deaminase deficiency. And then the other two are hereditary coproporphyria, which is from a deficiency of the coproporphinogen oxidase. I feel like I'm just butchering these words.
I'm having flashbacks to pathways in medical school.
Yeah. You absolutely practiced that in front of the mirror before we showed up, didn't you?
Maybe. Well, I'm about to butcher the next one. So the last is Varegut porphyria, which is from protoporphyrophenogen oxidase deficiency.
Of course, yes.
Say that five times fast. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting about that last one is it's the only one that presents with blistering. And that is where the word Varegut porphyria comes from, because these folks have skin findings that are exacerbated by kind of being out in the sun. But otherwise, all the other conditions do not have any kind of obvious physical exam findings, just kind of the subjective complaints that folks come in with. So kind of going back to acute intermittent porphyria, I don't want to at all describe to you the heme biosynthesis pathway. So we'll just kind of conceptualize what are the important pieces. And so it's important to have your porphyria rings, which are made into heme. And this happens in the liver. And it's important so that you can make red blood cells that'll carry oxygen. Acute intermittent porphyria is a defect in the porphobilinogen deaminase, which is the second step of the pathway. And because of that deficiency, heme biosynthesis is slightly reduced, although folks will have normal amounts of red blood cells and hemoglobin in their circulation. But if they have large amounts of activity from the preceding enzyme, then that's when folks go into an acute porphyria attack.
So like a lot of medical conditions, we have this pathway and there's a breakdown in one of the enzymes. Well, why aren't these patients having symptoms all of the time? What makes these flares occur?
So flares happen whenever there are increased amounts of the heme intermediates. And those intermediates are increased whenever the heme biosynthesis pathway gets turned on. And it gets turned on for really two big reasons. One is low amounts of circulating heme. So essentially anemia can turn on the heme biosynthesis pathway. And it also can be turned on by starvation. So people who get sick, maybe with a viral illness, and they're not eating for a couple of days, get some ketosis, and then it turns on the heme biosynthesis pathway, and then they go into an acute flare. So if you think about it, we starve or fast ourselves for brief periods all the time. We have a busy day, we skip lunch, we are late, we skip breakfast. Next thing you know, you could be in a porphyria attack, and you might not even know that you have porphyria. So in these patients, the step before porphobilinogen is aminolevulinic acid, and aminolevulinic acid is turned into porphobilinogen. And if you have high levels of aminolevulinic acid, I have a bird clock in my office and it goes off almost on the hour. It's about 7 minutes behind and it makes bird sounds. We're fairly certain that they end up in the podcast. So low circulating heme and starvation triggers the heme biosynthesis, and then the intermediates build up because of an enzyme deficiency. And then the next thing you know, the patient starts to have symptoms. And it's thought that these intermediates are having a wide range of effect, specifically on the neurologic system, which is where most of the symptoms are, but it's not actually understood why or how these intermediates are having an effect. It's thought that a lot of them are able to actually cross into the cytosol of a cell across the membrane, and that may explain some of the widespread effects, but it's not been proven or well studied.
If we're like Dr. Chrisman and really want to get this diagnosis, how do we go about doing that?
The first step is a high index of suspicion. So the reason Dr. Chrisman occasionally finds a case of porphyria is because he's always thinking about it. Someone comes in with abdominal pain and he always adds porphyria to his differential diagnosis. Whereas when I think of abdominal pain, I hardly ever add porphyria to the end of my list. So if you're thinking about it and meeting people who have been to lots of doctors and have kind of a long list of unexplained complaints, it could be that person. But the testing is actually fairly straightforward. In the setting of acute attack, you can check a urine porphobilinogen. And if it's elevated because they're missing the enzyme, then there you have your diagnosis. After that, the question becomes, what kind of porphyria do they have? Which enzyme is actually missing? And what are the genetics? And what does that mean for the rest of the family? And that usually requires referral to a specialist where they do further testing from the serum, the urine, and their stool, looking for the different intermediates and testing the enzyme levels and actually looking for mutations.
And once we've diagnosed it, tell us a little bit more about how we can treat this disease.
Treatment is based on shutting off the heme biosynthesis, and that can be shut off in two ways. One, which is loading the patient with hemin, which is essentially heme, which removes the signal to activate your heme biosynthesis. And two, if you don't have that available at your facility, you can start giving them glucose. You can put them on a dextrose infusion and remove kind of the starvation and ketosis and put them more in an anabolic state.
And that makes sense because you said the two triggers would be starvation and low heme, essentially. So the treatment is reversing those.
Exactly. And those treatments have been very effective since the 1970s. And they're very good at reducing, like when someone comes in with an acute flare, you can start them on hemin, start them on glucose, and they have improvement in their symptoms. They frequently require high-dose pain medicine in order to improve their symptoms. Occasionally, it can be complicated by seizure activity, and they need treatment of their seizures as well. But the real question is there a way that we can actually prevent these attacks from happening? Meaning we have a treatment that's kind of reactionary to someone who's having an acute attack, but is there a way that we can prevent them? And that's the, probably the most exciting part about acute intermittent porphyria treatment at this time.
So for decades and decades, we've known that smoking cigarettes is extremely harmful for a number of reasons that we're not going to discuss. And we've really been up for doing anything we can to get people to quit smoking. And one of the newer technologies that's been out that doctors have had a lot of trouble with knowing whether or not it was a good thing or not to recommend is vaping. And until pretty recently, we thought, well, we don't really know whether or not we can recommend it or not because we don't know too much bad about it. That being said, there is a ton of stuff in the news right now, and maybe the hottest topic in medicine is that of vaping-induced lung injury or vaping-associated lung injury.
Alex talked about vaping-associated lung injury, which I agree, Alex, is arguably the hottest topic in medicine right now. Although I am biased because I do love the lungs. I thought I'd start by sharing a couple of numbers about kind of recently how many cases there have been and how many deaths have been reported to the CDC. So as of the middle of January, there have been 2,668 cases of vaping-associated lung injury and 60 deaths. And this is all since really starting about the middle of 2019. So I think we can kind of look back like 6 months ago, just in August, we started hearing about this. And then the next thing you know, we started seeing our own cases. And then a couple of reports were published in the New England Journal from Michigan and in Utah, kind of describing the characteristics, the patients, what they were presenting with, what they were seeing on the CT scan, and what kind of vaping products they were using. So let's talk a little bit about how people are presenting with this and what kind of their clinical course and history goes like. For starters, though, folks come in with respiratory complaints. It can be a chronic cough. It can be productive or non-productive. And usually they have a fever and some shortness of breath, might even have a little bit of chest pain. And they almost always have pretty significant GI complaints, including abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting. On laboratory testing, they can even have elevated ALT and AST, and then kind of non-specific markers for inflammation, elevations in the ESR and CRP. On a chest x-ray, it might just look kind of like a patchy infiltrate. And on a CT scan, you can have a wide array of findings. The CT findings include bilateral opacities. You can have a little bit of a basilar predominance and occasionally some subpleural sparing as well. What's interesting is that the actual kind of underlying disease and etiology of these cases is very broad, meaning just because we're labeling it vaping-associated lung injury doesn't mean that there isn't a little bit more of an underlying cause. So some of these associated causes are acute eosinophilic pneumonia, organizing pneumonia, lipoid pneumonia, which is essentially seeing lipid-laden macrophages on a BAL, diffuse alveolar damage, ARDS, hypersensitivity pneumonia, giant cell interstitial pneumonia, and diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. I know that's a little bit of like a lot of names and a lot of associated things, but it's important to know that vaping has a very broad presentation.
Especially in the month of January, your description of these patients seems like anyone who could have a URI or the flu. How do we distinguish this from other diseases that we see?
That's a great point. So the first thing I want to say is that there is a definition from the CDC that you can use to actually classify a case as vaping-associated lung injury or VALI. That being said, it does require kind of the clinician's expertise to kind of ask the patient, are they vaping, and decide if they really do have something more common like the flu flu. The CDC definition is the use of an e-cigarette 90 days before the symptom onset. So in most folks who are doing this daily or weekly, they almost always meet that. And then some kind of pulmonary infiltrate on chest x-ray or CT. And then the next part of the definition is the important part. It's the absence of any pulmonary infection. So that means a negative respiratory viral panel, influenza PCR, and other testing for common bacterial causes like strep pneumonia, Legionella. So that might mean sending like a BAL or a sputum culture to rule out a bacterial cause. And then no obvious other cause of pulmonary symptoms such as heart failure, rheumatologic, or neoplastic process.
It sounds like you're almost doing a diagnosis of exclusion.
That's exactly right. So if you have a patient who is using e-cigarettes and then has no viral, bacterial, cardiac, rheumatologic, or neoplastic cause of their shortness of breath, cough, and infiltrates, then we call it vaping-associated lung injury. And
or porphyria.
Or that's right.
It's always on the differential.
That's right. Porphyria is always on the differential. So this is kind of what makes this diagnosis, or should we say syndrome, interesting, is because it doesn't tell you what is happening to the patient. It's just saying they're having lung injury and they have a history of vaping. And we have so many questions about what is actually happening with these patients. And the CDC is doing a great job of collecting and disseminating this information. And so based on the latest numbers, we know that 82% of these patients are using THC-containing vape products. And of those 82%, 34% of them exclusively use only THC. So that means that most of these patients are using nicotine-containing vapes and THC-containing vapes, and only kind of a minority of patients uses just nicotine-containing products. And this is relevant because a lot of the THC-containing products can be purchased on the street or come from friends or don't come from an actual reputable supplier and are more likely to contain contaminants or have kind of an unknown substance in them. This has led to a lot of interest into why suddenly are e-cigarettes causing lung injury when they have been around for several years now and have been used without any kind of obvious ill effect. And so this leads to a lot of interesting speculation, and now some more recent research has been published talking about what might be causing this.
Peter, I guess the question on everyone's mind is, why is this happening? I mean, obviously we've noticed this trend, but you know, until we figure out a little bit more about why it's happening, we can't really do much about it.
When the outbreak first started happening in August, I think folks thought that we were going to be able to identify maybe a bad batch or some kind of like obvious cause of what was happening. And the answer is it's more complicated than that. And the first part comes with understanding how does an e-cigarette work. So you have a battery, and then you have a reservoir which contains a liquid. And that liquid is usually, say, nicotine-containing liquid. And then you have a compressor, and then you have a heating element that heats a coil, which in a small chamber will vaporize the liquid, which can then be inhaled into the body. As these e-cigarettes have evolved, they've actually become smaller and they become more potent, meaning the vaporizing heating element can go to much hotter temperatures. And it was thought that maybe it's heating up so much you're actually getting small amounts of metal or actually like plastic from the actual e-cigarette itself. And inhaling those things is toxic to the lungs because, quite frankly, other than oxygen, you shouldn't be inhaling much else. So what happens when you're breathing in this vaporized liquid? You're inhaling all kinds of things like flavorings, formaldehyde, naphthalene, lithium, lead, silver, acetone, benzene, xylene, toluene, and another 25 to more chemicals, which is similar to cigarettes. There's hundreds of toxins that are being inhaled. But the most interesting and possibly thought-provoking finding has been that of lipid-laden macrophages. So lipid-laden macrophages just means you have macrophages which have phagocytized either other cells and their membranes are in vacuoles and are lipid-containing, or there are actual amounts of exogenous lipids that have also been phagocytosed by the macrophages. This was a classic finding of aspiration, especially in elderly patients who were using mineral oil for their constipation. And this was a long time ago because we don't really use mineral oil. We have lots of other stool softeners that are more common. We don't really see lipid-laden macrophages in our patients. But a lot of the patients who have vaping-associated lung injury do have lipid-laden macrophages. And one of the thoughts, and this was based on testing of reservoirs in New York, were that there were higher levels of vitamin E. And it's thought that vitamin E, when it's being inhaled, is actually being toxic on the lungs. However, because this wasn't true of every sample that's been tested, it's uncertain whether this is just an association or actually has a causative effect on the lung injury in these patients.
Why would vitamin E be in these e-cigarette liquids at all?
Not an expert on this, and I'm going to try my best to take a stab at that answer. But vitamin E is a very common antioxidant. It's a fat-soluble vitamin, and it's commonly used in all kinds of skin products and additives in food. So it's essentially non-toxic in most of its forms. However, the thought is that it's being added especially to THC-containing vape liquids because it can be used as a dilutant for the THC to make it either go further or to help emulsify THC into the actual liquid to help make it more vaporizable. And then it's being inhaled. And the inhaled form of vitamin E has never really been studied because no one was inhaling vitamin E, but the thought is that it's actually toxic to the lungs. A couple of thank yous today to Alex and Casey, our hosts, and also to Dr. Chrisman for his brief appearance. Can't wait to see you guys again soon.
Thanks, Peter.